What can Boaz tell us about men and potential marriage? What could you single ladies learn from Boaz? And what should single men aspire to be like? And what should ladies look for in a potential mate?
Movies, novels, and fairy tales have convinced many that when it comes to marriage, fate brings the perfect Prince Charming into a woman's life. Love at first sight follows, and then they live happily ever after. Of course, reality tells a different story. And on this edition of The Truth Pulpit, Pastor Don Green begins a series on marriage, showing what the Bible says are the characteristics of the right mate. Hi, I'm Bill Wright. And Don, you have a real burden for defending and encouraging strong Christian marriages. What can we expect in the coming program and series?
Well, Bill, we all know that marriage has fallen on hard times. People live together without shame. Divorce is common, even in the church, and that doesn't even take into account the more radical things that have happened to marriage from our Supreme Court in the past several months. So, my friend, this series is countercultural. This series is about you becoming a godly mate, a godly candidate for marriage, and knowing what to look for in marriage. If you're single, it will help you find the right kind of person to spend your life with. And if you're already married, there's plenty here for you too. We're going to rally around God's plan for marriage today and in the coming days on The Truth Pulpit.
We'll be in the book of Ruth, so turn there in your Bible as we join Don now.
Chapter 4, verse 1. Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So he said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. He took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the closest relative, "Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance." The closest relative said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, because I would jeopardize my own inheritance. Redeem it for yourself. You may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it." In this text, we see that Boaz is the marrying kind of man. He is a man fit for marriage. What I want to do is look at the narrative that we just read and kind of walk through it, and then draw some application about marriage and preparation for marriage and what you as a man, a young man, what you should aspire after in order to be properly prepared for marriage. And what you as a single woman should be thinking about when it comes to a husband. There are many, many things that we can learn from the life of Boaz. And for the rest of us, those of us that are married, there's plenty for us to see here, not only in terms of our own character, but coming together as a church, whether we're desiring marriage or not, you know, whether you're single and you desire it or you don't, that's okay. But coming together as a church and saying these are the things that corporately we should hold up. These are the things that we should reinforce in the lives and in conversations with our young people, with our children, saying this is what you should aim after in marriage. This is the kind of person either that you should become, or this is the kind of person that you should look for in marriage. Boaz gives us a wonderful example to see and to look at. Now, with that in mind, just a little bit of reminder of what was going on in Ruth chapter 3. You remember that Ruth had gone in at Naomi's suggestion and laid down at Boaz's feet and essentially said, "Cover me with the protection of marriage." And Boaz said, "I will do that. As the Lord lives, I will marry you, except it's not completely under my control." I have to defer to the closer relative who has a right of redemption over you, and I can't act until I know what he wants to do. And so, as you look at the end of chapter 3, verse 18, Naomi said to Ruth, "Wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled it today." And so, as we come to the conclusion of Ruth chapter 3, we're kind of sitting breathlessly waiting to see how this unfolds. The plot has not yet been resolved. There's still a tension in place. Ruth and Boaz want to get married, but someone else has a claim on her that must be resolved, and Boaz is now going to act in chapter 4 in order to bring resolution to the situation. And so let's look at verse 1 again, and we'll just walk through the narrative together. "Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by." This was the man who had the right of redemption. He was the kinsman redeemer in the closest sense to the family. And so Boaz called out to him and said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And so he turned aside and sat down. And there's this big meeting that is about to take place at the gate. The gate was the entranceway to the city. And it was at the gate where legal and commercial transactions would be conducted. The cities weren't open like we're used to. It was very close quarters. And so at the gate is where people would go in and out, and business would be transacted there, as opposed to a courtyard square like they used to have in some of the older designs of cities. And what happens here, what we see unfolding in verses 1 and 2, there's an element of formality that is going on here. There are legal issues at stake and legal rights and property rights that are being conducted. This wasn't simply a matter of romance between Boaz and Ruth. There were legal responsibilities, legal privileges that belonged to this closer relative that had to be resolved and disposed of before a marriage could take place. And so there's a formality to this that you might not sense on the first reading. And so as we go along in the text, we see the close relative pass by. It's interesting that the text does not give his name. Apparently, it's not important. Many commentators believe that the omission of his name was a way to diminish him in the text because he did not fulfill his responsibility as the kinsman redeemer. I don't know if that's really necessary to see, but one thing we can say for sure is that the name of this man is not important. He's simply a passing figure who appears for just a moment and then passes away as God works out his eternal purposes through the life of Boaz and Ruth. And what follows after verse 1 adds to the legal ceremony, the legal formality of the occasion. Look at verse 2. "Boaz took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, 'Sit down here.' And so they sat down." Now these elders were leading men of the city that had a certain measure of responsibility as city representatives, and official business would be transacted through them. You can see this if you look over at verse 9 when Boaz speaks to them later. They're serving as witnesses to the transaction that is about to take place. In verse 9, Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech." We're getting ahead of the story there, just long enough to see that these men aren't simply gathering around as friends. They're serving a formal function in what is about to happen. Now, we don't have any biblical or historical record that requires this number of people to be a witness to the transaction. There's obviously some kind of local custom, some kind of local situation that's being played out here, and these men are being called as formal witnesses, much in the same way that we might in a wedding situation have We have witnesses that sign the marriage license, or you have witnesses that sign a document that has a particular legal import. There's a similar situation going on here. And Boaz is about to deal with a legal matter, and so he sets it up in a legal way as he talks with this closer relative. And now with the relative in place, with the required witnesses in place, Boaz gets down to business in verse 3. Then he said to the closest relative, look at verse 3 with me, Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. Now, in some manner, Boaz is informing this closer relative about the situation. Maybe he's simply stating the matter so that it can be put into issue in front of the witnesses for formality. But nothing in the book prior to this time has said anything about Naomi selling land that had belonged to Elimelech. This is the first time that we're introduced to it here in the text. But if you think about it, it makes perfect sense that Naomi would be selling land. After all, she is a widow. She's got a life expectancy ahead of her, and she needs some manner of income, some manner of resources in order to sustain herself going forward because there are no men in her life anymore. And so she's selling the land in order to support herself and to fund her living expenses, which she anticipates in the future. And so Boaz here is informing this closer relative, this unnamed relative, of what is happening. And it was important, and you can read parallel passages in Scripture, it was important in Israel for the land to remain in the family, that the family line and the family land would be connected and perpetuated throughout the generations. And so this was something of quite great importance. And that's why relatives would be called upon to purchase the land so that it wouldn't go outside of the family in a sale and then somehow be lost and the income and the perpetuation of the family name be compromised in that way. Now notice that as Boaz explains it here in verse 4, nothing is said about Ruth yet. He's simply dealing with it as a land and a property transaction. Look at verse 4 with me. He explains the situation in stages. He says, I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. And so what he's saying is, I'm interested in buying this land myself, but you have a prior claim on it. And I want to inform you of that, and I want us to resolve this here. If you're going to buy it, fine. But go ahead and buy it so the situation can be resolved. But if you say you're not going to buy it, then I will buy it. And so they're walking through the legal process of redemption as this is being stated. Boaz, of course, has an ulterior motive. He hasn't put all of the cards on the table yet. He hasn't mentioned Ruth yet. He's simply unfolding it stage by stage, and it serves to kind of isolate what the real issue is. And so what does the man say? What does the closer relative say? He said, I will redeem it, there at the end of verse 4. And so the close relative says that he wants it, on the assumption that, in the context that, only the land is at issue. He thinks it's just a pure business transaction, and it looks like a favorable investment to him, and he says, I'll take it. Now, at this point, as we're watching this unfold, and the man says that I'll take it, keep in pace with the unfolding of the narrative, the whole scheme of Boaz's and Ruth's marriage is at stake. If he follows through on this redemption, Ruth will go with it and she'll end up with the wrong man. This is a horrible step for just a moment in the course of the romance. Everything is at stake with what comes next in verse 5. And Boaz said, speaking honestly, but also skillfully directing the conversation to the outcome that he wants. He says in verse 5, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. Well, that changes the whole situation. You didn't tell me there was a woman involved in the situation. You didn't tell me that there was someone that I had to marry. I thought this was just about the land. Now, we don't have the full details, once again, of why the one who redeemed the property also had to redeem Ruth. It was Naomi's land and Naomi's property, and now Ruth is brought into it. Again, our narrative doesn't explain all of the details of the property transaction that are involved there. Apparently, at the death of Elimelech, the property somehow passed to Mahlon, Ruth's husband, passed to him, and so that Ruth was somehow included in the redemption responsibility. But the text doesn't explicitly say it to us. It's content with leaving all of the legal details on the periphery so that we don't get lost in those and see the purposes of God being advanced with what is said. And when Ruth's name comes up, the closer relative, the first and prior kinsman redeemer, backs down. Look at verse 6. The closest relative said, "I cannot redeem it for myself because I would jeopardize my own inheritance. Redeem it for yourself. You may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it." Now, why would he do that? Well, he obviously didn't want to marry Ruth, but he says that it would jeopardize his inheritance. And what's going on here is that if Ruth had a son to the marriage to this man, that son would get a portion of the relative's estate, and the guy doesn't want to split his estate like that. He doesn't want to share it with Ruth's family. He wants to preserve the inheritance and preserve the wealth and the name in his own line and not pass it along. And so if Boaz wants to do it, he can have at it. And so he's looking to preserve his earthly inheritance along the way. But in the meantime, Boaz embraces the responsibility, and Boaz becomes the name that is perpetuated throughout biblical history, and this other man falls into obscurity. But he doesn't realize that at the time, and so he yields his right to Boaz, and that clears the way for Boaz to marry Ruth. Now, finally, all of the obstacles have been removed. Now, finally, they can move forward in their relationship, and there is nothing to prevent them from becoming married. Their budding romance can now fully bloom. And now, having seen that, I want to step back and kind of use this text for a pastoral point and to make some specific applications about men and marriage. And not just speaking to single people, as I said, but for us to have kind of an idea of what we can glean from the life of Boaz and in thinking about marriage. And in what we do here, we're going to do a bit of a short character study of Boaz and kind of review some things from the prior chapters. What can Boaz tell us about men and potential marriage? What could you single ladies learn from Boaz and aspire after in your marriage? What should single men aspire to be like? And what should ladies look for in a potential mate? This is an opportunity for us, really, I think. If I weren't a pastor, I might not go into this and take this little tangent, but as the pastor of the church, I feel some responsibility to say some important things about marriage and singleness and those kinds of issues, and this is an opportunity for us to do so. One of the reasons why we want to do this is to inject some objectivity into the consideration about relationships, which for most of you is coming before you're actually engaged in the relationship or you're already married. And it gives us an opportunity to think objectively about some things that sometimes would get pushed aside in the heat of emotion or a budding romance or, God forbid, manipulation from a man to a woman. And to just give you ladies especially something to think about, things for you to contemplate and to think through and to have an idea of, as to the kind of man, to have an idea of what, scripturally speaking, I believe you should look for in a man that would be fit for marriage. Now, as we say that, I'm mindful also, it helps that I've got five daughters of my own that will be hearing this stuff as well. Not that they haven't heard any of this before in one way or another. As I say this, and as we go into these five characteristics, the parallel is imperfect. Boaz is an older and established man in this text, but he nevertheless gives us a pattern to consider as we would all seek to grow in the grace and knowledge of Christ. And once again, let me just say, realizing that some of you marriage has been settled for a few decades, being mindful of the fact that this isn't just for individuals, but this is for us corporately. These are the things that we want to be able to think about. I want you who are older to be in a position to reinforce these things to young people, and so that we corporately direct them in a way that will establish them and help them find a good marriage and not be compromised in life because they made unwise decisions. And so when you ask the question whether a man is of the marrying kind, whether he's the kind of man that a Christian woman who wants to grow in grace should marry, is this kind of man fit for marriage? Here are five questions that I would encourage you to ask. And as I said, in this process, we'll do a short character study of Boaz in the context of how he handled his legal transaction in the verses that we just looked at. Question number one that you should ask as a young woman, and question number one that you should be contemplating as a young man for your own life. Number one, I'm going to address these questions as if they were to the ladies themselves. You should ask this question. Number one, is he godly? Is he godly? It's obvious that this narrative that we have in the book of Ruth is presenting Boaz as a godly man, as something of a picture of the greater Christ that would follow. He is affirmed, and he's obviously a godly man in what is being given. Well, what can we glean from his life that would teach us and instruct us from a book that is pointing toward marriage all the way along? What could we learn from it? Well, we ask the question as we apply it here in our lives in the 21st century. Is that man under your consideration godly? Now, Christian women have no business whatsoever marrying a non-Christian man. That cannot go well. And furthermore, let me just say a couple of points on that tangent. I'm kind of on the tangent of a tangent. What would it say about a Christian woman or a Christian person willingly entering into a marriage relationship with a non-Christian man? What does that say? First of all, it communicates to that man who you say that you love that matters of salvation actually aren't that important. You have inoculated him against the gospel when you tell him that I will marry you even though you do not know Christ. That can't possibly be right. That can't possibly be an expression of genuine love for that person. No matter what your emotions may be, you are leading him astray and teaching him all the wrong things about spiritual life. Secondly, what does it say about a Christian woman saying that, on the one hand, supposedly saying that the glory of God is the supreme goal in her life, and yet to enter into a relationship with a man who does not share that priority? Those two things don't go together. And so a Christian woman has no business marrying a non-Christian man, and really has no business even entering into a serious relationship with a non-Christian man. There can be nothing good that comes out of that. And the emotions that start to confuse you, and you compromise and you rationalize away all of the spiritual commitments that you had in the younger days of your commitment to Christ, that nothing good can come from that.
Today on the Truth Pulpit, Pastor Don Green has presented part one of a message titled, A Marrying Kind of Man. It's the first of a new series on marriage called The Right Mate. Next time, Don will give you more vital questions a woman must ask to ascertain whether a marriage candidate fits the biblical model of a good potential husband. Don't miss a moment. You know, you can hear any part of this series again at your convenience when you visit our website, thetruthpulpit.com. You can download podcasts or find out how to receive CD copies for your personal study library. Plus, you'll find the link, Follow Don's Pulpit. That'll take you to Don's full-length weekly sermons, not subject to the time editing needed for our radio broadcasts. Again, that's all at thetruthpulpit.com. I'm Bill Wright. May God richly bless you. And we'll see you back here next time on The Truth Pulpit.